Welcome to the podcast of the Geological Society. My name is Sarah Day and I'm with Tim Wright, who is a professor of satellite geodesy at the University of Leeds. And you've been talking about earthquake prediction and monitoring. And you mentioned at the beginning of your talk that more people are killed now by earthquakes than ever before, which seems incredible considering that the technology is moving on. Why is that?
Well, firstly, I didn't mean to talk about prediction because I don't think we can predict.
So prediction's the wrong word.
But I think what we can do is say something about probabilities, places that are more likely to have earthquakes, how often earthquakes might take place. So doing more forecasting rather than prediction. But in terms of your actual question, I mean, if we look back in the Middle Ages, then we had one earthquake every 20 years or so killed 10,000 people or more. If we get up to the 20th century, then one earthquake every 3 years or so killed 10,000 people or more. And we've already had seven of those this century. It's clearly increasing the number of people who die in earthquakes. Now, one of the main reasons for that is that people are moving and living in big cities near fault zones. So there's an increasing population living in hazardous areas.
So this is about populations rather than increasing frequency of earthquakes?
Earthquakes, we think, are happening at pretty much the same rate as they've always happened, but actually the vulnerability is increased, the exposure to that hazard is increased.
And when we think about monitoring earthquakes, I guess we think about people going off to remote locations and putting equipment in the ground, which is something that you've said that you do, but also it seems like increasingly satellite monitoring is an important tool.
Absolutely, and we're increasingly finding that we can gets a lot of the information that in the past we would have had to gone and spent long periods of time trekking through the desert to go and put instruments in or to go and look at particular sites. Increasingly, we can go and get that information from satellite data, whether it's high-resolution optical images and elevation data, so measurements of the height of the ground, which we can use to try and identify the features in the landscape, or whether it's actually the main technique that I work on, which is using repeated radar acquisitions. So we image the ground with a radar from a satellite. We do that again and again and again, and we make very precise comparisons between the signals from all of those acquisitions. And by doing that, we can track how the distance between the satellite and the ground is changing, and that's telling us how the ground is deforming at the surface.
And what sort of scale can you get down to in that?
So actually, what we need to get down to in order to make a difference for earthquake hazard is really very, very small deformation rates on the order of a millimetre per year, and actually not just a millimetre per year of 2 points next to each other, but 2 points 100 kilometres apart. We need to be able to measure their relative motion up to an accuracy of about a millimetre per year.
So if two places on Earth relatively move by a millimetre, you can detect that from space?
It's challenging, but yes, we can. That's the aim, is we want to be able to do that everywhere. At the moment, we can do that in selected areas. Within the next 5 years, we'll be able to do that for all of the tectonic belts on the planet.
That's something you're using to compare the ground after and before earthquakes, or is it something leading up to the event that you can use to say something might be about to happen there?
Okay, so we can use it, and we've used it very successfully in the past, to look at earthquakes. And so when an earthquake happens, the ground moves by quite a lot, actually. So maybe if you have a magnitude 7 earthquake, we might have 3 or 4 metres of motion of the ground, and that's relatively straightforward to measure. What's much harder to measure is that millimetre per year rate. So measuring the actual displacements in an earthquake is relatively straightforward. These smaller motions that happen between earthquakes are much harder, and they're the real target for us. So what we're trying to do, and what we think happens, we think that this is the way the Earth works, is that we gradually build up stresses. It's like putting on an elastic band, and so we're storing energy in that elastic band until the fault fails, the elastic band snaps, that's the earthquake. And so if we can measure the stretching of the elastic band and say which elastic bands are stretching at different rates, then we can maybe say something about the areas that will have an earthquake into the future.
So at the moment we're talking about forecasting rather than predicting.
Yes.
Is there ever a scenario in which we could start moving towards concrete predictions?
Probably not. Most seismologists think that it's probably impossible to give a short-term prediction in terms of there's going to be a magnitude 6 to 7 earthquake in this 10 by 10 kilometre box sometime tomorrow afternoon. We are hopefully in a position where we might be moving towards time-dependent forecasts. The one type of earthquake that is relatively straightforward to predict and actually give those kind of short-term predictions for is aftershocks. So if you have a big earthquake. We know the areas where aftershocks are most likely to take place, and we know pretty much how big they're going to be. So if we do want to predict a magnitude 6 earthquake, the circumstance in which we can do that is the day after a magnitude 7 earthquake, and we can pretty much say where those earthquakes will take place.
So we're getting closer.
So we're getting closer in some circumstances.
Yeah.
But for most earthquakes, they happen out of the blue.
And you mentioned as well a project that you're involved with called Earthquakes Without Frontiers, which is collaborating with social scientists as well.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the motivations for this is that we have a huge amount of knowledge about faults and how to measure earthquake hazard within the physical science community. For example, before the Haiti earthquake, scientists knew that the fault that eventually caused the earthquake was of high hazard and had the potential to cause a magnitude 7 earthquake. And yet on the seismic hazard maps and in all the information that policymakers and NGOs working in Haiti had, none of them knew that there was a high earthquake risk.
So this is a communication problem?
So it's partly a communication problem, I think, and it's about how, and one of the reasons for involving social scientists and working with them is to try and work out the best ways, not just to communicate it, but also the best ways to influence people and to understand the different cultural contexts as well. So the fact that doing this in China might be very different from doing it in Nepal.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, as physical scientists, we're not very good with people normally. So that's something that we need help with.
And you mentioned as well at some point that maybe it's a good idea to scare people.
Yes, I think one of the times when people are paying attention to earthquakes is after a big earthquake. So if there's an earthquake in a town in California, then you'll find that the US Geological Survey are on the TV news. They're bringing out their teachable moments. They're saying, make sure your bookshelves are attached to the wall. When you feel the shaking, duck and cover and go under a table. Those are the moments when people are paying attention, I think. So people know about tsunamis now, after the Boxing Day 2004 tsunami and the Japan tsunami more recently. Most people didn't know about tsunamis on the 30th of December 2004.
So it's a sort of getting that balance between panic or sort of paralysing fear and just making sure that everyone's aware of the risks around them, I guess.
Absolutely. I think we don't want to unduly panic people. I mean, the statistics for individual events are quite scary, of course, but actually they're relatively rare. But if you're living somewhere, then there are things you can do to improve your chances of survival when the earthquake eventually happens. The challenge is, of course, it may not happen in your lifetime, and there's economic and policy decisions to be made, which is, do you invest in retrofitting your schools so that they're seismically safe, or do you say, well, actually the cost benefit analysis of that isn't worth it. I think schools and hospitals, you think, really should be the priority, but actually individuals can make choices about perhaps whether they're prepared to take that risk. What they need to be, though, is informed of what the risk is, so understanding what the hazard, the potential hazard is. If you're told there's a 50% chance of an earthquake in your lifetime hitting your house, then I'd want to do something about it. That might not be true for everybody.
It seems like a lot of progress has been made in terms of forecasting. Are you sort of hopeful that this is all helping people on the ground in these seismically active areas?
Yeah, I think we are hopeful. I mean, there are places where things are happening as a result of the known hazards. So, for example, in 1999, there were two devastating earthquakes on the North Anatolian Fault just east of Istanbul, killing 30 or 40,000 people. And there's a very well-known seismic gap. There's a portion of the North Anatolian Fault just south of Istanbul that will fail at some point in an earthquake. Hasn't had one for 200 years. And finally, the local administration, the politicians, the society has woken up to this following the 1999 earthquakes, following the scare in the 1999 earthquakes. So there is a major retrofitting campaign going on. Schools are being rebuilt. Infrastructure is being reinforced, so there is hope, I think, that if you have the knowledge of the hazard, you can make a difference.
So it's really about that linking between the scientists and the infrastructure.
Absolutely,
and the policy.
Yeah.
Well, thanks very much for talking to me. The talk's going to be available to watch again on our YouTube channel, and you can follow along the GSL lectures via the hashtag GSL lecture. And thanks very much.
Thank you.